Welcome to the She Births Show Season 4, a place to inspire your birth, evolve your parenting, and help you live a life you love. I'm Nadine Richardson, your host and creator of the scientifically verified birth education program, She Births. I'm also a mother, yoga teacher, doula, author, and speaker. At She Births, we have supported thousands of families around the world for over 13 years with our unique program, and our vision is to make birth better for every family around the world so that everyone experiences a beautiful birth no matter what unfolds. Not only do we help people have beautiful births, but we also give them the skills and the philosophy to enjoy pregnancy and make parenting easier. As well as our world-class birth ed, taken either face-to-face or online, in our app, we also have a free pregnancy guide designed to help you feel calm, connected, and inspired as you and your baby grow. We have a doula matching service, the perfect way to ensure you and your partner are completely supported throughout the whole journey. And we have our Soul Mama Circles, which are the perfect postpartum network to help optimize your mindset and design your life in parenthood. Remember, if you like what you hear today, subscribe, share with a friend, and leave us a review. If you're a parent, about to be one, fellow health professional, join us now for an inspirational deep dive into topics with experts around the globe. We hope you enjoy this special episode. Over this pandemic, particularly the second lockdown, people have become more aware of their birthing rights, mainly in regards to having support people at their birth. Lots of people have fought for that right, and in Australia, they've just put out a policy saying it's essential for one person to be allowed, and there's a lot of restrictions around that. I personally don't think it's enough, but it's a beginning, and I can't actually believe we had to fight for that. But within that realization, the petition signing, the phone calling, the social media sharing, I have noticed that women are starting to realize there are lots of other rights they have in birth and in healthcare that the majority of us simply don't understand but want to know more about. So this podcast, I've invited a good friend, Anna Leotia, to help explain the context and the history of maternity care in Australia and how we compare globally. Also, how she works through the non-profit, community-centric organization she founded, Pregnancy, Birth and Beyond Media, to help bring about change. We talk about many factors that influence our healthcare and policies. We talk about what informed consent actually is. For example, a Queensland study recently of over 3,500 women surveyed showed that only 48% of women who had a planned cesarean section were informed and had actually consented to their procedure. And 26% of women were not informed or consented to their episiotomies. So we also discuss the wonderful unpaid work us women do, the lack of feedback in healthcare, what type of data is important in our decision-making. We talk about induction of labor, the need for responsive dynamic systems, the disparities of choices available to women in Australia, and what this all means to each of you at the end of the day. Because the truth is that no one is legally responsible for your birth except for you. So we're all born into this reality, but what has been created and now what sustains that reality is actually up to us to change. Maybe not for ourselves if we've already had our children, but certainly for our sisters and their families going forward and our kids and their kids. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. Anna Leotia, I am so excited to have you on the She Births Show. You are such a busy woman fitting in your schedule. Even though you live in the Northern Rivers, you seem to work like you're in the big city.
I'm trying to revoke my own pass that I gave to myself to work like a crazy woman. Working very hard.
Classic.
So welcome and thank you again. I wonder if maybe you could explain to us, you know, what you do for a job or what you have done. And because I'm always a little bit confused, and it would just be amazing if you could explain, you know, your career, your path and where you are now.
Okay. So definitely a journey, beautiful windy road for me. I'm currently teaching women public speaking and leadership skills and workshops and trainings and programs with the incredible program called Woman Speak, which is created by an internationally acclaimed thought leader, Casey Baker, in the US, who's worked with women all over the world, you know, including women in the United Nations and TEDx and the US government. And these are incredibly beautiful skills and support systems to help women to really come out of them, their shells, and speak their truth and contribute to the conversation and join the table, basically. And one of the main reasons I was drawn to doing this work, I've been doing it for about 3 years now, is because I've spent about the past 8 years in advocacy and consumer representation in the area of maternity care. And it took me a while, it took me a few years to really understand the landscape of healthcare and maternity care. And through that time, I really came to understand how deeply unsupported women are in the areas of motherhood and families in general, but especially mothers. And yeah, so I've been very passionate. It made me even more passionate. The more I understood, the more I wanted to do. So I've spent firstly, you know, kind of getting into different areas from mother support groups to being invited onto the Pregnancy, Birth and Beyond show to be a radio host. And I did that. And very quickly within that realm, I realized that because I came from a background of production, I'm a producer. I spent 20 years now up to now in this field of because this other area is not-for-profit advocacy work, so not being paid, I've still had to maintain my my job as a producer in different areas. And so I could see how much potential there was in alliancing some of the smaller groups that are working in this area and getting everyone together under one umbrella so they had more of a voice and more power. And so very quickly, having joined the radio, Pregnancy, Birth and Beyond, the team that was there at the time, I convinced them to basically start a not-for-profit media organization and not just be mums racing around trying to get this important information out there through, you know, either the radio or attending conferences or doing screenings for their local communities, but also to kind of combine forces. So we started, we founded PBB Media. PBB stands for Pregnancy, Birth and Beyond. And that's been an incredible journey of essentially connecting the dots between the many stakeholders in this arena. I think oftentimes people don't realize that, you know, they're walking into a hospital to give birth. They think it's them and the doctor on the day, or them and maybe the hospital policy. They know a little bit about that, but they don't realize that the pie of maternity care and birth is shared by many, many stakeholders. Powerful stakeholders, and actually the health consumer in terms of how much weight and power they have within that conversation depends on a few things, but generally is very limited, very limited. It's like they're a little slice. They get a tiny slice. First of all, from even just the choice of where to go to give birth, but we'll get into that a little bit later on.
Yeah.
But so what we did with PBB Media is work diligently and incredibly meticulously in understanding the landscape in which people access healthcare services, and not just in the short term, but in the long term, because we're interested in whole community, whole family health, well-being for everyone, basically. So it's kind of our...
Well, because everything comes through family, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, we see it as the seed and soil.
As, you know, capitalism does as well, as religion does as well. You know, there are definitely a select group of people that don't have families, but the majority still do. Yeah.
Then you can't have capitalism without families. In fact, women or mothers are the biggest consumers of things and drivers of consumerism as well. Where to buy a house, what car to get, where to send the kids to school, what, clothes, all of this kind of stuff, all the stuff that we get for the house. It's a lot driven by that. So whether or not you end up having a family, you've absolutely come from some form of family, whether even if that family was broken. And it is our aim to keep families as healthy and well as possible, as connected and healthily bonded as possible, so we have more bonded, healthy societies. So individuals in the community, in our society, are actually well and healthy and well bonded, because it is incredibly rare that a healthy, well person that came from a healthy, well family is going to then turn out to be harmful to themselves, their communities and families, or the environment.
Yeah.
And so those three things are intricately linked to that seed and soil time. How well we take care of each other, how well we take care of ourselves, our bodies, our health, our mental health, how well we take care of our families and our communities, and how well we take care of the environment is intricately linked to the seed and soil phase of a human being's life, to how healthy the pregnancy was, how safe the mother was during pregnancy, what the status of the birth was, how traumatic the imprint of the birth itself on the mother and the baby, and their ability to start this lifelong marathon together in a healthy, well way, and not with a broken psyche or being, body that really impedes that journey, that critical journey, the first 2000 days of life. Some it's first 1000 days, it depends on which policy and which research you look into, but essentially from the moment of conceptions to 5 years old to three is essentially critical, but also up to 5 years old is an essentially critical period for each of us as individuals. And yeah. So our focus at PBB Media has been really to break that down, look at all the different stakeholders or aspects that impact a person's first 2000 days, let's say, and beyond, of course, because everything's connected. You can't cut out, you can't look at the health of a human being and say, right, we'll just cut the heart out and make the heart healthy, yeah. Chuck it back in, and that's it. That person's not going to be healthy. It doesn't work like that. It's a system. It's organized to work together. It's symbiotic. It's ecological, biological, all of this kind of stuff. And so from our perspective, to really spread it open and start looking at, first of all, what's going on. Secondly, where things aren't working, where there are issues in the system or in this whole picture, this map. And then figuring out a way to make sure that those areas that are not working are starting to work. And what we realize is that oftentimes all these different areas are working in silos. They're not communicating with one another.
Yeah.
And so us as a not-for-profit, volunteer-run organization, primarily by mothers with young children, so really limited with how much.
Gosh, that sounds like my business.
Yes, well, that's a lot of businesses like ours are actually run by passionate mothers who are working on their own time and spending all their time and effort to make sure our community is better. And we're talking here at a large scale for us, but any mother who's contributing to volunteering at the canteen or setting up the fundraising to get a new park at the preschool, a new slide at the preschool, all of these things, these are often roles that women have been doing for centuries to support the community. Grandmothers helping out, we're taking care of the young, we're taking care of our elderly. There's a lot of stuff we do, but from the perspective of PBB, we really wanted to make sure that we understood the landscape, that we could really assess and understand where the issues were, and then that we were actually doing something about it. Not just going, blah, 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 that's bad over there. Because, there's a lot of that going on in the world. There's a lot of like point and blame and shame and all of that kind of stuff. And actually, we can't get anywhere with that kind of attitude. In fact, it bogs that shit down. Apologies for the
Oh, you can swear on our show. It's fine.
Yeah. And So, yeah, and we figured out that the best way that we can do it as a small not-for-profit organization run by volunteers with a very limited budget, that the best way for us to do that is to cross-pollinate the information between the many stakeholders. So we set that as one of our main goals. So
you're going to have to explain that to us, cross-pollinate between all the stakeholders. So obviously corporate people are going to understand, you know, the term consumer, advocacy, stakeholders and stuff like that. But personally, I didn't understand that those terms, you know, until like 5 years ago when I started working with big, you know, health funds and stuff like that. So what do you mean by cross-pollinate between the stakeholders? What does that actually mean?
Let's start with the most important stakeholder, the key stakeholder of all, and that's the health consumer. So that's everyday people, Australians living in this country that are consuming healthcare products, right? So when you go to the doctor, you're consuming a healthcare product. You might not see it like that, but in terms of terminology and how funding works and government and policies, et cetera, that's how that's the jargon over there. Just basically means that you're paying for a product, whether or not that's being paid by Medicare or you or whatever scheme is going on to.
You're still the consumer.
Yeah, to pay for the service. You're still the consumer of the service, and the service is the healthcare product, whatever it is, or healthcare itself or the product of healthcare. So that's number one. The health consumer is just everyday people, me, you, Nadine, anyone not living on our street. And then we've got the maternity healthcare consumer. So a person who's accessing maternity healthcare services, whatever they may look like during their perinatal period, you know, from conception to postnatally, they're accessing any healthcare services, they're a maternity healthcare service. They're a maternity health consumer. Okay. Yeah. A maternity health consumer is a person accessing maternity healthcare services and products during their perinatal period. And so our focus is often coming back to this area, to the maternity healthcare consumer and the related services and products that exist in this area, and then again all the other stakeholders, which I'll go into a minute, because of the seed and soil part. So we do look at other areas of healthcare and the long term and, you know, all of this stuff, but again our focus is in that area because of the critical impact that it has in the long term.
Yeah.
So that's the maternity health consumer. That's one stakeholder, and we believe that is the key stakeholder because that is the stakeholder that carries the seed and soil promise of, you know, a better future for us all, right?
Yeah. So now,
but like I said before, the maternity health consumer is often in the picture of who's got power and who gets to make decisions, etc. They're a little sliver of the pie. So it is part of our aim is to inform the consumer, first of all, that they are a consumer, that they are part of a pie, of a map of, you know, of a bigger picture thing. So they're aware of what they're, you know, what they're going into. Secondly, to support them to communicate better with the other stakeholders and to understand kind of the context in which they're accessing services, but also, of course, then to cross-pollinate between the other stakeholders. So it's not just the consumer knocking on the door trying to say, I'm important, but for the other health, not just health, but other stakeholders to understand their relationship, their rights, their responsibilities, the impact that they're having when they're, you know, when they're providing a certain type of care or a certain culture exists, blah, blah, blah. So another stakeholder, for example, is the insurance companies. So insurance companies heavily influence what kind of care is available to us here in Australia. For example, you know, when you're going into a hospital, the hospital is insured by an insurance company, and that insurance dictates to a degree, to a certain degree, there's a lot of things that dictate what kind of services are available at a hospital, but to a degree they dictate what can and can't be done in a hospital. They also in many ways help to shape policies inadvertently because they don't allow certain things and they do allow certain things. And, you know, the more risk, it's kind of built into a risk profile, and it's hard to understand. It's a lot of information, so I won't go too much into it. And also I'm not like an expert. I'm a mum who spent many, many years doing lots of research and has spoken to hundreds of stakeholders, thousands of stakeholders really over the years,
sure,
to understand what's going on. But I'm not an expert in insurance or in hospital policy or how the intricacies of how things are built in. But insurance is certainly a stakeholder, has a stake in how we experience maternity healthcare services. Then you've got clinicians is another form, another stakeholder. And within that, you've got different types of clinicians. So you've got the midwives, you've got the obstetricians, you've got nurses, you've got in some understandings, like every person that actually comes into contact with a person who's giving birth is a form of a stakeholder, because they found out that through research that even like a janitor passing by and saying, oh, you looks like your baby's really hungry, could really impact the mother's ability to breastfeed. So in a way, there's like the major players and then there's all little ones on the side, but we'll concentrate on the major players, so the clinicians. And then so each clinician group within that stakeholder group of clinicians will have different agendas and different training and different capacity to different power structures and stuff like that. So why is this important? So as a consumer, as a person accessing the care, you're walking into hospital and you're like, right, I'm going to see my midwife today. They know what's going on. And they'll take care of me. This is the general gist of what people who access healthcare services are thinking. They're not thinking, they don't understand all these other aspects. They're not thinking about it. It doesn't interest them. And
they're not thinking about, for example, who owns that hospital, who insures that hospital, how that impacts. I mean, the Northern Beaches hospital that was built with private and public next door, which is an issue inside of itself when it's built by one company. You know, we saw such
a corporate money-making company, so for-profit company, not government.
Very different. Yeah, very different ramifications for the woman giving birth in that space, you know. So, yeah, you're right. People aren't thinking about all these other stakeholders that have filtered down into, they're just thinking about the midwife has got this or the obstetrician's got this. So what kind of happens then?
Well, that's just a tiny amount. As other stakeholders are the local health districts or the health and hospital, the HHS is in Queensland. Each state has their own. Those are the bodies that have been designated to provide public healthcare services in each kind of local health district area. So in New South Wales, we have local health districts, and we have HHSs. I can't remember what they're called in Victoria right now. But it's essentially the group that's got the responsibility to provide healthcare services. And they've got their own way of understanding health. They've got their own agendas and what they're meant to be doing. They need to meet budgets.
They also have their own money as well. So yeah. Health district gets their bucket of money from the federal government and they can distribute that as they wish, completely different. So a Blacktown hospital could be different to, you know, a Campbelltown hospital and Manly, you know, because they're in different health districts as well.
Completely. So I mean that's one of our biggest issues in Australia today is the disparity that exists for all the people accessing healthcare services in Australia. So a woman in Blacktown will receive absolutely a different service from a woman in the Northern Rivers, for example. Here we've got publicly funded home birth program. We've got a 100% continuity of midwifery care for everyone who does get into the program at the Byron Hospital, for example. They all receive continuity of care from a team of midwives who are the main care providers, while as you know, in a hospital in Blacktown, they might be receiving, I don't know what the Blacktown hospital is, but in an other designated hospital.
Not great.
Yeah, not great. There you go. The majority of women in Australia are receiving fragmented maternity healthcare services, which means they're not receiving care from the same 1 to 3 care providers for the duration of the pregnancy, the birth and postnatal leave up for the first 6 weeks. So that's one
which
of our...
Means, wait, which means, just to make it really clear for people, that the majority are not receiving what is best practice based on the evidence base that has been collated with Cochrane reviews and randomized control trials for 20, 30, 40 years internationally. the majority of people are not receiving the gold standard and certainly not best practice in, really important to drive that home.
100%, there's zero doubt as to what the gold standard of care is in maternity healthcare in terms of outcomes for mothers and babies. The best care, the one that reduces harm, reduces morbidities and, you know, and all these other things that happen in the short and long term for mothers and babies is midwifery-led continuity of carer within a good setting. So it's not just any random midwife that's providing care. It's obviously one who's well-trained, who understands, who's got that correct training. And part of the problem here in Australia is we're not giving excellent training to midwives. We're giving really good training to midwives compared to, though, in New Zealand, they're receiving an extra year. New Zealand, there's 86% midwifery continuity of care, 86%.
Wow.
In Australia, we have about 10% continuity of care with midwives. That's a huge, that's 70, you know, that's a lot of difference. There's a 76% difference in terms of what women are receiving in New Zealand.
And I can just concur with you on the training of midwives, because I've taught midwives out in Westmead and the Royal and all different places, and I'm amazed that they don't actually know about normal physiological birth, the hormonal orchestration, a lot of them, practical tools, those inner and outer resources, no knowledge from the training whatsoever. So unless they actually seek that knowledge out, they don't find it. Or unless they attend, you know, birth centres and home births, they don't often even see normal physiological births. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the same goes for obstetricians. The number of obstetricians who've seen a normal physiological birth in a normal setting, like in a less complicated setting, are very few.
And now for a quick break.
At She Births, the mother is at the centre of everything we do. We believe that birth and matrescence is a sacred rite of passage, and we believe that the journey is unique for everyone. Wherever you are in your journey, She Births is here to support you. Starting with our free pregnancy guide, which offers you 6 months of weekly support. You will receive nourishment for body, mind, and soul via your inbox and engage with content within our free app. Enjoy yoga videos, recipes, birth affirmations, course discounts, and so much more to help you feel calm, connected, and inspired for birth. Sign up online to our free pregnancy guide on our website, shebirths.com, and download our free app today in any app store.
And I mean, that's the thing. So when somebody accesses healthcare services, they don't understand that there's a spectrum of different situations that are impacting on what care, type of care and the quality of the care that they're receiving. They just think, I'm going to this hospital and there's a midwife. Not all hospitals are the same. Not all midwives are the same. Not all care providers are the same. Not all the structure in which everything's built from a local health district perspective in terms of what services they want to offer to that local area are different for each different area. I mean, there's so many things that are, and to, you know, responsive, dynamic services are incredibly important. So it's not like we're locked into one single way for every single person. We do need responsive dynamic services. It's key and critical for the longevity of healthcare services globally to have responsive dynamic healthcare, which means it's responding to needs of the community in that area. The problem is that when it comes to women and maternity and babies, the needs, the experience of these women and mothers and the families and the people who are accessing maternity healthcare services in the long term are very hidden and shadowed. And they're somewhat understood. We've got like patches of understanding of what's going on for these people when they're accessing healthcare services, but we are very ill-informed of the actual real stories of what's really, really going on for people. And partly that's because of how our healthcare services have structured their feedback loops They're not meaningful. They're often tokenistic. And even now there's like a huge effort from the government to improve, because they've known for years about these issues, that to improve, first of all, the data, they don't even have proper data collection. Up until recently, they weren't collecting data accurately. Some data wasn't even collected at all. And then there's different terminology for each hospital, decide on their own terminology of what.
And private hospitals don't have to provide data.
Private hospitals don't have to.
I just find that astounding.
It's like, I mean, you in any other industry or area, this would be a shit show. Like a shit show, to be honest with you. And it's hard to understand this. Like people say, you know, Australia is considered to have one of the best maternity services in the world in terms of how many women die each year, how many people die in birth. But that's not a measure of a good service. They think they've got a good service because, you know, they've got
mortality
is relatively low. But that's just one measure. And that's not at all the only important measure. How mothers are walking out of birth, how able they are to bond properly with their babies, what kind of access they've had, how many interventions, what was the situation in which these interventions were incurred? Were they medically necessary? Were they pushed because of a timeline? You know, we've got a situation here in Australia that when come Christmas, heaps of babies are booked into C-sections because doctors are going away. And that's not a medical necessity. And the impact of C-section, major abdominal surgery, in the long term, not just the short term in terms of recovery and blah, 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 we can't even begin. There's heaps of info, but we're not beginning even to put it together in terms of the impact on population health overall.
Yeah, we in do terms so of biome and all sorts of
things. Everything, biome to, you know, breathing issues to this, to that, and especially with COVID and pandemics and, you know, God knows what, in the long term, we want healthy as possible individuals walking out in the world. So they are, you know, and C-section impacts incredibly on a person's health.
I mean, it's not just the C-section as well. I mean, like you say, you're talking about instrumental deliveries, what's women's pelvic floors like, you know,
the state of
trauma. And someone, please God, explain to me why 45% of the Australian population needs to be medically induced.
They don't need to be induced. It's not a medical function. It is a cultural function.
That's right.
Unfortunately. So some of those will definitely need to be induced, some number. It's really hard to tell, obviously, because these things fluctuate over time. But one of my favorite quotes from a professor at Harvard that I recently interviewed around C-section, he was like, C-section is the most performed surgery on human beings in the world. I was like, I've been in this for 8 years. I had no idea. I was like, what? I knew it was a big one, but I didn't realize it is the number one most performed surgery on human beings on the planet, the cesarean section. Yeah. I mean, that is so telling. And what also he said, and I'm going to paraphrase him here because I didn't take the quote.
Wonderful Neil Shah.
Dr. Neil Shah from Harvard. Yeah. You can look him up. And maybe we can put the link to that podcast.
Yeah.
Interested, because he dropped some bombs that I was like, I'd been doing this for so long and I was on this side, you know, from the consumer perspective. And here's a professor at Harvard of obstetrics, he's considered one of the 40th smartest people in healthcare in the United States today. So, like, highly intelligent, you know, dropping all these bombs on me, and I'm like, oh my God. Like, he was also saying that C-section, the diagnosis of C-section is the most incorrect diagnosis. To do a C-section is the most incorrect of all the surgeries. And so, I mean, that's just an example of where maternity care is at in terms of the impact of culture, the impact of the stakeholders, the impact of, you know, all these different things that are feeding into a person's health consumers' experience on the ground that they're often completely unaware of. And that's at PBB has been our major role in terms of getting the information out there, helping to cross-pollinate it. So we talk to academics, we talk to hospitals, we talk to health districts, we talk to consumers, we talk to different clinicians. We haven't talked yet to insurance companies, but That's not our job. Someone else can talk to them. Maybe the wife of an insurer might have a traumatic birth one day and realize that the impact.
I know, I've been there. I've worked with them. It's hard.
Yeah, it's very hard. It's
kind of like interesting that you say we know that we need responsive, dynamic healthcare.
Mm.
I have never worked with such dinosaurs in my life.
Yeah, they're not as responsive.
They're not responsive and they're not dynamic. Yeah. And the cogs turn so incredibly slowly. And even big corporations that have innovation hubs for entrepreneurs, they bring them in, and the actual ability to integrate or to grow with or to scale is virtually nil, because it is incredibly hard to change these dinosaurs. And we know from research that it takes 17 years on average for evidence base to be implemented within a system, if it happens at all.
It happens.
What does this all mean? Like, what does this all mean for the maternity healthcare consumer? What does this actually mean, Annalie? What can we take from this? What can we do?
Well, a maternity healthcare consumer is a very unique health consumer. Compared to all other health consumers, they are in a very different position. So when do you go to the doctor, Nadine?
When I'm really, really sick.
Yeah.
When I need medicine to band-aid symptoms.
Yes. Or if you've broken your leg. Acute
in an emergency.
Accident, some emergency situation, exactly.
Yeah.
Or when you're needing to maintenance, do a checkup and see how your health status is.
Perhaps
in order to prevent potential future, right? To prevent potential future issues that may arise, like screening and testing and all that kind of stuff. But a maternity health consumer is going into this very complex, very rigid at times, very clunky, like you said, a dinosaur. The healthcare system is incredible. It's like a massive machine with a million cogs. It's moving very slowly like that, and very hard for it to change. Like, the reality is that it won't suddenly morph into a fairy. It's gonna be dinosaur. It's dinosaur is a nice word. I don't know why you chose dinosaur. It's like, you know, you got to think of these dystopian big, you know, things. They're working hard to not make them look like that, but in fact inside it's all like million cogs and hard to move and a lot going on there. Hard to change perceptions, hard to change the culture, hard to change the actual things on the ground. Well, they've invested so much of money in, you know, the rooms and the walls and the things and the machines, and the people are part of that. It's all kind of interconnected. So, you know, the health consumer accessing maternity healthcare services is a person, sometimes with sickness, sometimes without, you know, they're on their own health journey spectrum. From well to unwell, all the time. We all are. Like, in this moment, I'm somewhere along my health journey spectrum, and tomorrow and in half an hour and in 3 weeks, I'll be in a different part of that spectrum. You know, it's not black and white, ill, unill, you know, ill, healthy. It doesn't work like that. As we all know, we need maintenance. Our bodies are complex living organisms. They require constant input. We can't just sit at home for 5 weeks and do zero. And then, you know, we'll move down the health spectrum a little bit. And there's heaps of things that impact our health and well-being status as well, from mental to, you know, all of these different things are feeding into our own personal formula of well-being. And so the person that's pregnant going accessing these healthcare services, they are generally, you can't really define where they are on the health spectrum, but generally the process of growing another complex living organism inside your body, which is again a complex living organism in its own right, is a biological process, is a physiological, biological process. It's been happening for, you know, millennia, blah, blah, blah. We don't get here without that process. It's a normal physiological function of the human body. And just like doing a shit, going to do a poo, or doing a wee, or breathing. I know it sounds like gross, but no. It's just, this is a, like, you don't, to go to do a poo or to do a wee, unless something's wrong with you, you don't need a machine or a thing or an intervention. Your body's doing its thing, it knows what it's doing, and generally, and depending on where you are on that health spectrum, you know, you're lowering or your risk of other things happening are impacting into that pregnancy situation and the birth and the postnatal situation, which includes the bonding, the breastfeeding, the seeding of the microbiome, all of these different things that are going on postnatally. And so this person is having a normal physiological process and they're accessing a system that was built to address illness and manage disease or address emergencies. So, from the acute side, healthcare basically is split into two aspects, the acute and then the primary healthcare, which is, you know, long-term and just general health and well-being, like diabetes, this, that, the other. And the acute is emergency, heart surgery, all this kind of, you know, things that happen in an emergency. But where does the pregnant person or the woman who's pregnant fit into this scenario? They're having a normal biological function and depending on their own health spectrum, accessing this disease management and acute care management system. And unfortunately, they don't fit in very well. They're kind of like they're a bit shoved in there in this kind of, oh, let's put you in the ward or do this or and give the same mindset and the same functions that are have been created to address acute and chronic health is superimposed or fit, you know, that person has been put into that gown. Yeah. I mean, literally, I love Jim Gaffigan, the comedian, is like, you know, we gave birth at home because we didn't want to give birth in the gown that somebody died in yesterday. You know, it's one of my favorite, not to say that everyone should give birth at home, but it's a telltale in terms of, you know, you're going into an area which is highly risk averse because maternity care is highly risk averse because there's a baby involved and our moral values get ignited around babies and around life and safety and all of that kind of stuff, which is a huge part of the impact or a huge part of the influence, excuse me, of what happened in this area. And if people don't understand moral values and stuff like that, Jonathan Haidt, who's a social psychologist, he's got a theory around moral foundations, the moral foundations theory. He's highly respected, well known. It's a great thing to delve into. Just look up Jonathan Haidt, moral theory or moral values, or I can't remember exactly. We could put a link up there.
Yeah.
It really helps to understand how we're triggered to, our decisions are triggered by our moral values, and different people have different moral values around core parts of what about our existence, basically around safety and freedom and all of this kind of stuff. It's a great kind of piece of information for the puzzle in terms of understanding human behavior and experience. So that's happening as well. And also there's the most highly litigated area is obstetrics. Yeah. So there's a lot at stake going on here. So a person's accessing these services within this thing. There's high
in this context, in this culture.
Yeah, within this crazy context, yeah. So they're accessing a disease, something that was created to prevent and heal and take care of emergencies and diseases, but they're may or may not be unwell. So regardless of that, that's still primarily the only form of care that they have available to them, because in Australia, for example, we've got 98% of people give birth in a hospital. Less than 0.5% give birth at home. And for context, this is important. People think, oh, that means home birth is unsafe. In Holland, 15% of women give birth at home. In Brazil, in private hospitals, 85% is the average. 85% give birth in C-section in public private hospitals in Brazil. 85% of babies are born with a cesarean section, up to 85%. Well, the average, it changes a little bit all the time and they're trying to reduce it now. But there are some hospitals, private hospitals in Brazil, that perform 95% of their births are cesarean sections. So, and they happen also between Monday to Friday and 9 to 5. It's like, it's a cultural thing, birth, maternity care, pregnancies, postnatal, it's heavily cultural, heavily.
Well, I don't know. Value. I mean, I just want to break down this cultural thing because I think things, all the sort of policies and the history of how, you know, hospitals have been created and where maternal health has ended up, all those influencing factors from the past and from our stakeholders actually now goes on to create a culture.
Yeah.
Because culture is sort of pejorative in the sense that it's saying this is acceptable now, you know? And so, you know.
No, I just mean that.
Yeah, I just want to be.
The actual culture is the influence of what care you're getting rather than the latest in evidence-based science and
care. That's right. That's true.
That's not what's happening. Yeah. It's that's the right. culture that's influenced, the prevailing culture, which is made up of beliefs and made up of moral values, made up of what the history, what's just been done in this area for in this particular location for over this period of time. For example, in the United States, when medicine became industrialized, they criminalized midwives. They criminalized women taking care of women. That was put into the code, into law, that women were no longer allowed to take care of women. And that wasn't because that the male doctors had better understanding of birth. They'd actually never been attending birth for thousands of years. It had been the domain of women. It was because that women were the lesser and they wanted to have kind of a control over maternity care, which was the only area they didn't have, women's reproductive areas. And in order to do that, they had to criminalize the women who were taking care of the other women. So it's great. Another piece of the puzzle that's really important to understand. In the United Kingdom, where that didn't happen, there was no criminalization of midwifery. However, hundreds of years ago, when the Inquisition was happening, we killed, you know, hundreds of thousands of midwives and women who were taking care of people in the community and stuff like that in the, you know, in the witch hunts. Blah blah blah,
and I think people will go, "Oh, well, that was history, and that doesn't matter now." But you know, if we actually look at America now, it is still criminal in a lot of states. I don't know the exact number to have a home birth midwife.
Yeah,
and it's just because we need a quorum of people to get together to formulate a change of policy because that policy is clearly outdated.
Absolutely. That's all it is, and people don't understand that they think they're accessing equitable best practice care, but they're not. They're accessing the prevailing culture, which has some of the best, some of those. It's not like medicine is not evidence-based. It's not like that. There is definitely an influence, but they're not the only stakeholder. If you look at stakeholders from an even wider perspective in terms of what's really feeding into things, I mean, evidence-based care, the most quality evidence is not the only thing that's influencing healthcare. Absolutely not. Like if anyone says that, come and talk to me because I will debunk that in 10 minutes. That is just absolutely not true. There's a lot of things that are influencing what care is available on the ground to people. It's just structural, it's financial, it's risk, it's litigation, it's a medico-legal framework. We didn't even talk about that. The legal framework that's imposed onto the medical framework that is totally influencing what kind of care is available in each bit from that particular hospital to the, you know, local health district, to the state, to the country. And that's different everywhere all around the world. You know, there's a lot feeding into this. And
There really is. And just in terms of that structural, you know, even just down to the architecture of a hospital changes C-section rates, as Neil Shah has studied as well, when the birthing room is further away from the nurse's station, C-section rates go up because the anxiety when the buzzer rings for assistance is so great by running that extra, you know, 20, 30 metres. It escalates internally within the practitioner's mind and is more likely to go to a C-section. That's what Neil Shah has talked about as well, which is fascinating.
So fascinating. His one of my favorite quotes of him, I'm trying to find it right now, is I forget what it is, but it was something like that risk of having, I'll find it later. Let me not paraphrase him because it's such a powerful one. I'll find it later and we'll put it on there. But it was some, what was the main reason for you actually having a C-section? Was not your medical situation, but the hospital you give birth
in. Chose, yeah. The place that you chose, yeah.
Yeah, the place that you chose. Well, chose is a very strong.
That had access to because of all these different
you
barriers.
Had access to. It's not choice. I wouldn't call that choice.
When no.
When you've got only one option, that's not choice. That's totally. Like, that's the reality that you have. Yeah.
Totally. So when the woman's experiencing all of this, you know, what is it, again, like what does it really mean for her? What can you actually do apart from being conscious of this, apart from therefore I would hope that by being aware of all of these factors, you know, that you would ask questions, that you would be engaged more in your care and understand that care should be collaborative, right?
Yeah, well, obviously, 100%.
But people don't see it like that.
So legally speaking, maybe this sometimes, this fact sometimes helps people understand kind of where they stand within this picture. But legally speaking, you are responsible at the end, while your faculties are,
in place.
And it is extremely rare, like it is not some kind of, pregnancy or birth does not render you incapacitated for your legal faculties. Even if your hormone and you're in pain and all of this stuff, those things do not render you. So people sometimes think that those things do render you incapable of making decisions. Even you think that about yourself. But the fact is that birth and pregnancy and postnatal, these are incredibly serious and incredibly impactful aspects of your life. You don't go and buy a new car. Let's say you're spending 60, 50, 40 grand on a new car. You don't go and buy this new car without doing a bit of research into which is the best possible car on the market at the moment, who has the best prices, who's delivering the best service in the long term, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. You don't go buy a house for $1 million or $650,000 or $400,000 without doing your research, without understanding the context in which you're buying this property, who are the best, you know, real estate agents, the history of that property. You do a test, is there termites, blah, blah, blah. But you're going to walk into the hospital doors for one of the most, more than any car, you know, more than any house would ever be. The impact of this, having a baby and growing your family is the most monumental part of your life. One of the most monumental. Most people would say that. Maybe it's not everyone, but absolutely the majority of people would say that looking back as well in hindsight, that was one of the most biggest things that changed their life, from being without children, being with children, from being with one child to two children to three children. You know, these are big, big things that are happening, big, important things. So we don't walk into those doors into receiving care with the attitude of like, you know, oh, la, 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 you know, and people do that, but you got to take this a little bit more seriously. So legally, you are responsible. So that's legally, right. At the end of the day, regardless of what care you received, legally, you are responsible for that care because you gave informed consent.
And now for a quick break. She Births is where science and nature come together. As the only scientifically verified birth education course in the world, we can help you understand nature's intelligent design for birth while learning the most evidence-based birthing skills. We know that by getting to know yourself and by educating your team well now, you will be able to manage more of the challenges ahead with ease and grace. From our free pregnancy guide to our world-class birth education, to our post-birth Soul Mama Circles, you can be supported to find the mother within you. Our doula service is bespoke and provides only the best-in-class trained birth support to She Births families. Over 60% of our mums choose a doula in their birthing room, and we know that they will have the best care, best pain relief, and evidence-based support for their empowerment. Go to shebirths.com/doula, D-O-U-L-A, and book a free 15-minute consultation today to discuss your needs.
Let's talk about that. I really want us to talk about what informed consent is, women's relationship to power, and also how this all weaves into the pandemic and COVID and one person's support and all of that kind of stuff. But let's just talk about what informed consent really is, because many times I've seen things in play that I'm like, that wasn't informed consent. Like, no one explained to that woman fully what could happen if this occurred, or something happened by a provider and it was happening as they said it, and then the woman said, okay, you know, as the moment was occurring. So let's just talk about informed consent and what that really is.
So even within that sentence, there was a bit of inverse power, and I'll talk about inverse power in a moment, but even within that sentence, you were saying no one informed that woman. That's an inverse statement, because the woman is 100% responsible legally for her own body, right? She has rights and responsibilities over that. And legal responsibilities, obviously, over your own body is different. You get to choose, because that's your right to choose. So nobody's going to come and sue you for being unhealthy, although there are consequences to that, etc. But let's be very, very clear. The person that's responsible for what happens to their body is that person themselves, right? So legally, that's how it works. So informed consent is basically a person's decision, a person, me, the health consumer, a person's decision given voluntarily to agree to a healthcare treatment, procedure, or other intervention that is made following the provision of accurate and relevant information about the healthcare intervention and alternative options available. This is the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare. This is a fact sheet for clinicians, but I'm reading this one out because it will address both.
Yeah.
And with adequate knowledge, the second point being, with adequate knowledge and understanding of the benefits and material risks of the proposed intervention relevant to the person who would be having the treatment, procedure, or other intervention. Not relevant to what the doctor thinks about their care that they're providing, but relevant to the person receiving, the material risks and the potential benefits of the proposed intervention, relevant to the person receiving the intervention and the care, okay? Yeah. So the informed consent is that person's decision, their own decision, my decision, given voluntarily, not through coercion, not by being told facts that are incorrect, by fear or scaremongering, or by pressures of time or anything like that, given voluntarily to agree to a healthcare treatment that's being conducted on my body, or any procedure, following only, you can't give consent unless there's been provision of accurate and relevant information about the healthcare intervention and other options. And other options, not the singular option, if other options are available, and with adequate knowledge and understanding of the benefits and the material risks of the proposed intervention. For example, if you have this induction of labor now at 38 weeks or 39 weeks before you've gone into natural, what is it called now? My brain's not in that area.
Spontaneous labor. Yeah.
What are the possible material risks as well as the benefits? So what's the benefit? Why would we be doing it to begin with? Like, what are the benefits that this healthcare provider thinks? And what are the material risks? So material risks would include the percentage of people who go on to having an emergency C-section, for example. What's that percentage? You need to understand. And also the material risks of accessing care from that particular care provider, because Dr. A has a 30% C-section rate, Dr. B has a 40%, Dr. C has a 67% C-section rate under their care. And does that correlate with high-risk pregnancies? Not necessarily. You might have, do you know what I mean? You don't know. And so this is part of what you have to understand in terms of your responsibility when these when you're accessing healthcare services, it's you're giving informed consent. Doctors and care providers cannot do anything to your body without that informed consent. That's why you're signing all those forms.
Yeah.
They're not allowed to. It's legally not allowed. So they have to tick the boxes in the hospital that they've filled out all the forms and you've signed everything. But it's not true informed consent unless you have been given the relevant and accurate information, have been shown other options, have been explained other options, and that you have adequate knowledge and understanding of the benefits and material risks of each specific thing.
I love that. I love how you sort of broke down the relevant to the persons, because that's really interesting. But also I think voluntarily given alternatives, you know, it makes me feel good that we teach people in She Births the acronym BRAND to be that conscious engagement in decision making. And when I teach benefits, risks, alternatives, when we get to alternatives, I'm like, don't expect them to be the ones with alternative suggestions. But you definitely need to look at all of those things. And I suppose one of the things that I'm getting a bit frustrated with now as data gets sort of thrown around is we can look at short-term data, say, of the increased chance of a C-section with an induction of labor. But what about the medium term and the long term, the effects on the mother and the baby and the family? So there's lots of data out there showing that with an induction of labor, we see a 30 to 36% increase in postnatal anxiety and depression. Mm. How does that impact a relationship to a baby? I've seen women with extreme insomnia as well with their anxiety. How does that relate to, you know, the medium and long-term relationship and family dynamics and feeding and so on? And I think it's really important to not just look at short-term data. We need to look at medium-term, long-term, the ripple effects that could potentiate. And we're not saying that induction of labor isn't, you know, necessary and extremely important, and C-sections as well, but we need to go deeper and broader and longer with our perspectives right now. Yeah.
I love how you frame that. I mean, to me, there's no real discussion about the quality of maternity healthcare services without the long-term data. It's just not a real discussion. Yeah. Anyone who's talking about the silo of pregnancy to 6 weeks and, you know, maybe the first year is completely ill-informed.
Yeah, right.
And also incredibly damaging in that attitude. It's incredibly damaging. I wouldn't consider that healthcare. If we're not looking at the long-term impacts, meaningfully looking at them and understanding the context in which those impacts are playing out in terms of family health and well-being, community health and well-being, etc., we're not really talking about the quality of healthcare service, that particular healthcare service. We're just talking about something that's easy for us to frame so we can move on with the conversation.
That's so true. Or sometimes people grab short-term data to simply push an agenda.
Well, that's what I mean. So you can move on to whatever agenda you've got in that moment. It's easier to contextualize it in a small, you know, I always think giving analogies from a different sector is very supportive. And you can think about this, you know, in another way. Sometimes we're so bogged down in our own consciousness and understanding and awareness of our own kind of burrow hole that we neglect to realize, you know, this is, I mean, there's a lot going on here. There's trauma normalization. There's a lot of normalization of different things that we're doing to women and families and people accessing healthcare services within this context that are allowable. Just for example, take now, like I saw a post from a woman who had a C-section on Instagram the other day. And, you know, I'm not giving that as a valid, you know, piece of accurate information, but because I've been in this arena for so long and have been, I'm also the former national president of Maternity Choices Australia. And I've took that role just in the precipice of COVID. So the whole year has been around listening to stories of people who've accessed healthcare services. So I'm using that as an example of something I've already heard before. But this particular post was of interest because basically the woman had given birth by C-section, had to have a C-section in order to have her baby come out. And her husband was only allowed to stay for an hour or something post the birth. But then, like, and she wasn't allowed any other care people to support her, not a doula, not her mother, not a friend. Nobody could else come because of COVID restrictions. The husband had to leave. He wasn't allowed to stay with her or with the baby or anything within a couple of hours of the birth occurring, of the C-section occurring. Now, anyone who's had a C-section knows that they're incapacitated for a few hours post. Absolutely. There's major abdominal surgery. There could be extra drugs. There's a lot going on. They're in pain. They can't lift the baby. There's a lot going on there. A lot.
Alone like, trying to feed.
Yeah. That's just the physical. Then there's the emotional. And in order for a baby to form healthy bonds with them, they need to be with their mother immediately, skin to skin, breastfeeding, all of that has to be established. There's no, you don't get a second chance in those first few critical hours of a human being's life. You do not get, you can reestablish and all of that kind of stuff, but it's going to have an impact. That in itself, of reestablishing post the critical time, is having an impact as well. So everything has to be weighed up here. It's not just like, you know, one piece of information. But that father could then go and watch the footy in person with 2,000 other people.
Wow.
How do you explain that? How do you explain that? You can only explain that with culture. You can only explain that by looking at the bigger picture. So, you know, people thinking that they're, that what they're accessing is equitable and based on accurate information, on best practice, is not necessarily the truth. If people looked at the long-term impact of childbirth and maternity care, they would never tell that father to go home, not for a second, and they would allow another person as well, because the dynamic of power in a relationship, as we know, having seen all this information come out lately about coercive control and domestic violence, and especially during COVID where those numbers go up exponentially, we cannot just have this a partner being the single person that is allowed to support in you know,
no way,
or even just, it's not, they're not saying just the partner, they're only allowing one person, but sometimes the partner wants to be there, but because of the dynamics, that the person, especially if she's a woman, she needs that extra support because of the you know, whatever situation they're in. So us applying some kind of blanket rule over all healthcare services, and again, the maternity piece being so devalued in there and so poorly understood because we're putting it within a disease model of care, you know, and just blanketing over these highly impactful, exclusive, exclusionary, you know, restrictions, those have impacts in the long term. And then allowing men to go to their footy, I mean, it's like, you know, the mind blows.
It is. And it's, I think it's so baffling that it's almost just perplexing and confusing, and it seems overwhelming. So I just want to bring people's attention to the fact, you know, in the first lockdown, because we're in New South Wales, you know, we had incidences where, and we've had it in the second lockdown, where fathers were not, or partners were not allowed to attend a birth with a mother. And we're still seeing that in Ireland and sometimes in the US and all of that kind of stuff. And in this second lockdown, groups of doulas and midwives have fought very hard, particularly in that southwestern part of Sydney, to ensure that New South Wales Health, Brad Hazzard and his mates, all passed down this legislation saying that one person is now allowed. And we will share a link to that document. But from my experience, it's simply just not enough. It's not enough because we're getting mums that are having to choose between their doulas and their partners coming in, partners missing the actual birth. If a mum's in a state of overwhelm, she wants someone there with her that understands the healthcare system, that can get that hip squeeze exactly right. You know, it's a horrible dilemma to be in. And I think it's inhumane. Women deserve what they deserve, which is true support throughout the labor and birth experience. Don't you agree?
Oh, yes. So, I agree to nothing more on that than the fact are that this seed and soil part of the human being's life, of the family life, of the community and peace are lifelong impacting. And this seed and soil part has to be protected, has to be properly understood, it has to be nourished and supported and not just relegated to the realms of the broken leg, where if you've got a broken leg, you can have one support person with you, but not two. We're not talking about that. We're talking about literally the health and well-being of a person for the rest of their life, literally the health and quality of the relationship between them and their parent, their mother and the parents, and the relationship between the two parents, if it exists, and the well-being of the community in the long term. We're not talking about some broken leg which is going to heal in a few weeks.
Yeah. Okay? I think we need to acknowledge the fact that so many women, and I say to them, you know, that you had a traumatic birth, you were spoken to in this way, because the majority of trauma, as we know, comes from the way that a woman was spoken to during the procedures or about procedures that needed to happen. It's not necessarily about the procedure themselves. It's more to do with the communication and lack of respect.
And the procedures themselves can be absolutely.
Like, absolutely. They can.
Patting your vagina and you've said no, that it was the no. The fact that somebody did it without your consent, but also the actual cutting itself, yeah, is much worse than it would have been if that was done consensually and for medical reasons.
Absolutely. Yeah. From a respectful place. Yeah. Totally. But I think it's really important when I talk to mums postpartum and there's a degree of trauma there around how things unfolded. They are A, exhausted, B, not in a strong relationship to their state of power in general in life, because none of us really are, because we're used to being subjugated in a patriarchy. But three, they're flooded with like oxytocin and estrogen, which is all about adaptability, which is all about collaboration, which is all about keeping the peace, keeping harmonious relationships and making that more important than ourselves. So we're actually pushing shit uphill in these points during our pregnancy, postpartum and parenting periods. So I really want to implore families and mums out there to pay it forward. Like if you are out of that estrogen oxytocin state and like myself, like Annalie, our kids are older, then get involved and help women who are going to come through the next batch, the next round. Mm. Because if it's too hard right now, I get it. It's hard to write those letters, to deal with stuff when you're busy, busy, busy. But at the same time, if you can, get involved politically and fight for your sisters to have a better experience than what you had, or as good an experience as what you had, and ensure that that happens and ensure that our healthcare improves and that the seed and soil period is one that we foster and cultivate and nurture. Because Me Too movement is not just about the corporate world, the political world, you know, the life on the streets and so on. It actually applies to maternity and to healthcare. And we need to wake up around that and take care of each other.
Absolutely. I love all of that. I love all that you've said. And you've really touched on one of the key issues in terms of this whole arena. You know, the overwhelming majority of people who give birth are women. And for those who don't understand what I've just said, some people who give birth don't identify as women. You know, they may be trans men or just non-binary whatever it is, they don't identify as the woman. But the percentage of those people who don't identify as a woman, who are not a woman, and who have never thought about identifying as well, you know, I'm including those in the woman bracket, the percentage of those who don't identify as a woman is minuscule compared to the you know, the overwhelming majority of people who give birth are women. And so the history of women, the context for women is this ongoing, still today, like a lot of women are born out with rights that they don't understand that they, first of all, they have these rights that they're born into a reality and they're going to school and they're opening their own bank accounts and going to work and maybe they're paying a bit less, maybe they're not getting as much promotions, but they're not seeing it. They might think of it as a personal thing. You know, women don't understand the fact that there have been women primarily women fighting for their rights, and men as well, absolutely, and men, but people have been fighting for the rights of women to become more equitable and more, women to become more valued in society for centuries, yep, and centuries and centuries. Where, I mean, it's in 1979 or 78, whatever it was, you as a woman were not able to go to the bank and open your own bank account with, unless your husband signed. So this is like before, just, you know, on the precipice of the 80s. So
yeah, it's wild.
Don't understand how that impacts how people perceive women. And when you're giving birth, this is like your most, you know, these are your womanly parts, the female parts that differentiate between you and the male parts. You know, a male doesn't have a womb, and they cannot grow a human being inside their body. And, you know, these are the things that differentiate. And historically, women's oppression and women's not having a women not having a spot at the table or in decision making, and all this all deeply plays into maternity healthcare services, whether we want to admit it or not, whether we have a capacity to see it or not. It's absolutely there. It is, in fact, probably one of the most critical aspects that determine and define the way a woman experiences childbirth and maternity care, and that seed and soil period of her child's life, is the fact that she's a woman.
Yeah. Wow. I think we need to leave it there, but I want to encourage everyone to stay in touch and to be involved through our newsletters and to check out Pregnancy, Birth and Beyond, and both of our social medias, of course, She Births as well. Because we really want to rally right now through the second lockdown and going forward for women's rights to have their support persons, for partners to also be supported by their doulas is critical as well, so that they don't come out traumatized. It's really critical that we look after our families because we're looking after the future. And it's important that we pay it forward. For our sisters and brothers as well. So I want to thank you, Anna Lee, for your beautiful work you've done and your devotion to women and families. I just love you. You're amazing. And everyone should check out PBB Media. It's so good.
And Maternity Choices Australia. It's one of our oldest not-for-profit consumer, maternity consumer advocacy and representation groups. They're doing amazing work. We're doing amazing work. And, you know, we definitely want to hear from you.
Maternity Choices Australia.
And PBB Media. It's pbbmedia.org and maternitychoicesaustralia.org.
Yeah,
incredible work and organizations. And always just, whatever people know what they can do in their own communities, you know, we know what's needed, and we just got to act on it. We just got to start connecting with other families, other women, other mothers. It's all available.
It is. All right, darling, we'll speak to you very soon. Thank you again, love.
Thank you so much. Bye.
I'm Nadine Richardson, and you've been listening to the She Births Show. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share with a friend, and leave us a review. We'd love to know what you would like to hear more of. You can find me and my team of amazing doulas and educators at shebirths.com and our awesome community on Instagram and Facebook. Within any good app store, you can download our free pregnancy guide via She Births, two separate words and plural, as well as access our range of online courses. Remember, when it comes to having a better birth, an easier transition into parenthood, your education is your empowerment. Don't forget to check out the catalogue of previous podcasts, and thank you for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed the show.